Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Show podcast is off to the races. On this episode, I talked to Kenny Hsu, author of An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. He says that the success of Asian Americans should be enough to debunk critical race theory. Then we go to Maryland to talk to a husband and wife who, over the past 27 years, not only adopted more than 100 children, they also hold the distinction of being one of the first black couples who were allowed to foster a white child. From there, we go to the community of Omena, Michigan, where a very unusual mayoral race is heating up, with more candidates in the running than there are buildings in the town. A plenitude in the hopper today. But first, we start here. We're going to find out how Eric Smith feels. He's an associate professor of rhetoric and composition at York College of Pennsylvania and co-founder of Free Black Thought, author of the 2020 book, A Critique of Anti-Racism in Rhetoric and Composition, The Semblance of Empowerment. And I defer to you because you and your wisdom perhaps are following this a little more closely, but we've got a math curriculum that is again going to stress decolonization and breaking down racial barriers. I didn't know that mathematics necessarily lent itself to being interpreted as promoting white supremacy. It's something akin to critical race theory that I know is a very hotly contested issue in your country. So tell me what you make of all of this. Where are we going with this?
Well, I mean, the most obvious problem is that many educators have given up on black, Latino, indigenous students when it comes to things like math. And other aspects of education. This is happening with writing as well. There are a couple of professors at the University of Waterloo who are promoting the idea that standard English is inherently racist. So that's going on as well. Regarding math, like so many of these other disciplines, they are being fitted into a narrative, right? And that narrative is one of victimhood of people of color and the inherent oppressive nature of what's called whiteness. And when you overlay that onto education, normal things become aspects of white supremacy. For example, the idea of direct, precise, deductive, and linear thinking, which are very important to doing math, are considered inherently white and therefore racist to expect from students of color. So obviously, if you take this to the logical progression, this is doing more harm than good for students of color. But apparently they don't care about that.
Well, why then would they, in other words, continue to enable this victimhood? I mean, if you would have thought that they would have clearly had the best interests of black young people in mind. So what's the victimhood card what are they hoping to reap by playing that card?
The initial idea about why this victimhood works is because there's something about the curriculum that doesn't pay attention to students of color. That's the idea. And if we keep going with this victim narrative, we can justify changing education to cater more to students of color. There's this idea that the educational gap, the gap in standardized tests, for example, is the direct result of racist policies and nothing else. Obviously, it's more complicated than that. But the idea is that it's all about racist policies, not just in education, in other aspects of society as well. So when you have that idea, you want to change pedagogy, the philosophy of education in general. This victim thing, you know, is a pretty good way of going about it. You know, this idea, this rhetoric that we're trying to save the students by creating education that's more conducive to where they are and their cultures, that sounds heroic, but really does more harm than good.
Again, Eric Smith was Associate Prof of Rhetoric and Composition at York College of Pennsylvania and co-founder of Free Black Thought. You know, critical race theory, for what it represents, being taught in schools, now being embraced in a lot of different precincts or states, you know, where it effectively is saying that systemic racism is keeping the marginalized and blacks included amongst those oppressed. There's a lot of pushback from parents now at school boards, but why is this so widely being embraced by, as I say, certain precincts?
Well, I don't know exactly what's going on in Canada, but here in the United States, there is this push for what's called critical race theory. What's manifesting in schools is actually something a little different from that, derived from critical race theory, but, you know, still problematic nonetheless. And we can get what's going on with these schools from writers like Robin DiAngelo, who, along with some other educators, have created a, quote, anti-racist set of tenets, unquote, for education. One of them is, the question is not, did racism take place? But rather, how did racism manifest in that situation? And what that means is you're not looking for racism in order to eradicate it. You're already convinced it's there. And when you're already convinced it's there, you have to now justify your opinion by fitting things into a racist format. So suddenly things like linear thinking and direct communication, the fundamentals that we teach children are somehow inherently racist. And why this is going on? Well, there's been a push to do this for decades. It's reached its fever pitch right now because of last year, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, all those things sparked a kind of zeitgeist for all of this. But this has been in place for, people have tried to put it in place for decades now. This came out of legal studies, which came out of a neo-Marxist think tank, believe it or not. So, I mean, it's very complicated. It's very emotionally charged, right? But if you take this to the logical progression, if you think, okay, what are our students going to be like in 20 years if we have this curriculum? Well, we're going to have a lot of people who see racism everywhere and who want to break down the system. Bettina Love is an educator and a leader in this kind of education. And she says outright, A, our job is to tear everything down. The next generation can build it back up. And B, to do anti-racism correctly, you have to be anti-capitalist. So those ideas, she's not the only one who shares those ideas, obviously. They run throughout educators to promote, quote-unquote, CRT-based education. If you look at it that way, it's even scarier.
Well, you called it neo-Marxism. I mean, it's inculcated a lot of the public discourse, as far as there's still any kind of discourse. It seems like it's a one-sided affair, but, you know, even the idea that systemic racism is a self-evident article of faith, you can get in trouble if you were to deny that. But I don't know, as a black person, and again, the co-founder of Free Black Thought, what are your thoughts on systemic racism?
Well, there are definitely structures out there that, you know, have been put in place and haven't really been thought about regarding their impact. Desegregation was a good thing, but it also robbed a lot of people of color of their jobs as teachers, right? And it didn't really help students, you know, enter into, you know, white schools. There was no welcome wagon, so to speak. Also, when it comes to property taxes and things like that, they affect schooling funding and things like that. So there are aspects that need to be fixed. The issue is when people say that structural racism is everything, right? Students are doing poorly on standardized tests. Well, structural racism. You know, there's a gap in, you know, wealth. Systemic racism. You know, everything is systemic racism and not other aspects, like aspects of culture, right? What is valued and what isn't in the home. The nature of the family at home, all these things, and systemic racism work together. unfortunately, what CRT does is put everything on systemic racism. It takes the onus off of the actual people to acquire resilience, positive self-regard, agency, right? And puts all the culpability on institutions. And that will also do more harm than good. It'll create people who see the incentive of being victims. And that's not good.
And might you say that Asian students, their success belies the notion of systemic racism. They work within the same systems, don't they? I mean, but they've been successful.
Well, they're also called white adjacent. You know,
I never heard that.
Really? Oh, yeah, I hear it all the time. It drives me nuts. There's also a term, multiculturally white, right? What these terms mean is that any person of color, especially Black, Latino, Indigenous, who is successful must have just internalized white supremacy. You know, they couldn't have done it any other way. They might as well be white. You know, so hence Asian Americans, Indian Americans, and actually West African immigrants are succeeding. And, you know, they justify this by saying, well, you know, they're just abiding by the white supremacist status quo, which we're trying to get rid of. So they're not really Black. They're not, you know, they're not really minorities. They are, you know, well, multiracially white.
Wow. So they're reduced to gerrymandering their arguments around a lot of different peoples. Interesting. Eric, we got to have you back on at some point. I mean, in a full flourish of discussions on other avenues dealing with these topics, Free Black Thought is something that you want to look up. And also the book from 2020, A Critique of Anti-Racism in Rhetoric and Composition, The Semblance of Empowerment. That's Professor Eric Smith. Kenny Xu is now weighing in with us again, An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. Been trying to rack my brain here and wrap my head around the ideas for a while now of white privilege, systemic racism, and so on and so forth. And it seems that your book is almost a full court press against this notion, An Inconvenient Minority. So tell me exactly what your premise is here, your theory, and how it puts to a lie, I guess, the critical race theory that posits, you know, the system is rigged against visible minorities.
Well, Asian Americans debunk the whole notion that the system is rigged, because here's the thing. If the system was rigged against minorities, how would all of these white people let all of these Asian Americans ahead of them? You know, in things like the SAT, things like educational outcomes, Asian Americans go to college at a higher rate, things like financial outcomes, Asian Americans have a higher median household income than whites in America. And this is not because Asians are some kind of preferred race or anything like that. In fact, Asians have been historically discriminated against in this country, but it is because of culture. And that's what the left does not want people to understand, does not want people to talk about. They don't want people to talk about the fact that your life is still fundamentally your own. And that's what my book, An Inconvenient Minority, is really trying to express. It provides a direct hit against this false narrative of systemic racism in our country today.
Well, Kenny, you know, with that narrative, though, I've heard some of those proponents or apologists for it saying that Asians really fit into a different category. They're actually, what are they? So adjacent white or multicultural white. How do you respond?
Okay. So the idea that Asian Americans are white adjacent. You know, it's funny because a lot of these Asian Americans came to this country and then they didn't even know English. How could you be white adjacent if you don't even know English? 80% of Vietnamese immigrants come to this country and they don't speak the language. You know, so it's ridiculous to suggest that Asian Americans are somehow like profiting or benefiting off of white supremacy, because they came here with disadvantages even Black Americans don't have, such as language barriers and that kind of, and cultural barriers and that kind of access.
Well, all right. In the sense, though, that, you know, this has now taken on a whole dynamic where it used to be, I guess, meritocracy would be celebrated and lionized. First of all, I mean, do you think that the moral panic following the murder of George Floyd just over a year ago kind of tipped the scales on race diversity and identity? Has that sort of been the game changer here?
I think that the epidemic on George Floyd provided the opportunity for race hustlers and leftists to pimp their ideology upon the American people. This has been stewing. Critical race ideology has been stewing within universities and elite institutions for many years, for the past 50 years, in fact. Harvard, that's when Harvard Law invented critical race theory. But recently, because of George Floyd, it provided that opening because it was a universally acknowledged reprehensible act, but it provided the opening for all of that pent-up academic nonsense to be fully unleashed in our culture. And right now we're witnessing the whirlwind of what has been stacked up for a very long time.
Again, Kenny Hsu, author of the new book just out this week, An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. You mentioned Harvard, and I know you've been closely affiliated with Students for Fair Admission in their case against Harvard University. I believe it's a lawsuit. Tell me about that and where that one stands. What really spawned all of that?
So in one chapter of my book, I talk about this nationally recognized Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard case. Harvard discriminates on the basis of race. They treat Asian Americans worse on the admissions process. If you are an Asian, you have to score 440 points higher to have the same chance of admission as a Black American. Harvard justifies this, of course, in the name of diversity, which means we don't want too many Asians. That's the translation, by the way. And finally, the Asian Americans who were incredibly well qualified, much more qualified than the people Harvard chose to admit. Finally, they sued Harvard University and they said, okay, enough of this. We don't want you doing this. If this is legitimized, then all of these other institutions are going to do it. And now corporations are discriminating against Asian Americans. No, we're going to fight against it. And they did. And they have taken the case all the way up to the Supreme Court, where it will be decided next year. This is a case, a very fundamental case, that I think could launch this pushback for meritocracy that we so desperately need in our society right now.
Kenny, there's an argument, though, and it's been around for a while, that there was a need for affirmative action or quotas to redress historical imbalances in hiring, promotions, positions of power and influence, media, academia, and so on and so forth. How do you respond to that?
Maybe there was back then. Maybe there was in the 1960s and the 1970s. But now we're getting to the point where Harvard's affirmative action programs aren't even allowing or not even supposed supporting the kids that they're purporting to serve. You know, over 71% of Harvard's Black class is now wealthy and upper middle class or higher, and over 50% of them attended private schools. You know, we don't live in a country anymore where Black Americans should be treated or are uniquely an underclass. They're very successful now. Many of them are very successful, and we should accept that and praise that and celebrate that. I do believe that we should help the truly underprivileged, which includes Blacks, whites, and Asians, but we should never use race-based treatment to do something like that.
Well, again, that is the critical race theory that sees everything through that particular prism, that somehow, again, it's systemic and systemic discrimination. What I'm curious about as well is why academia, and even in primary schools now, it's become a real sore point with some parents, you know, going against their own boards. But the liberal media willingly adopting and promoting this theory, they're aiding and abetting it. Why is and it happens with elite schools, even below university or college level in New York City, as you point out in your book. Why is that? Why is cheerleading taking place?
Because there has been a push for equity in our nation, because people are looking at the Black-white achievement gap in America. And they're like, well, why are Black people underperforming? You know, and they feel guilty about that because America has had a history of racism against Black people, and they feel like in order to help black people. We need to artificially boost them into these gifted and talented programs that they're not as qualified for. But of course, the unseen cost of that is if you want to do that, you're going to have to reject somebody. So who are the people that they choose to reject? Well, they choose to reject these highly qualified Asian Americans, often coming from poor communities in New York City, who study the heck to get their opportunity to get into a gifted and talented program and which they're uniquely qualified for. And it, what that does is that that engenders immense bitterness between races in our country today. And so you have to really consider the consequences of what you're trying to do if you're going to artificially inflate people of a certain race into these gifted and talented programs in New York City.
So this divisiveness of which you speak, I mean, identity politics and all the rest, it seems like it's really polarized America, Canada, maybe not so acutely, but I mean, there's some of it still percolating under the surface. I mean, what's the best way to countervail that? It seems like, you know, this white liberal guilt is on the march right now. And so, I don't know. I mean, you want to return to a meritocracy. How is that going to be achieved?
White liberal guilt is a very powerful machine right now. It has resulted in hundreds of millions and billions of dollars to Black Lives Matter, billions of dollars to Stop Asian Hate, which is not really dedicated to fighting Asian hate, by the way. It's really dedicated to positioning Asians as a victim group against white supremacy. That's a factoid for your listeners to know. But what we can do about it, we have to focus on race blindness. You know, I'm president of a group, Color Us United, colorusunited.org, and we are launching a massive, massive campaign against the institutions in America who are trying to divide us by race, because we know, and data, and we've done our own data research that suggests this, only 29% of Americans even believe their race is important to them whatsoever. And we know that this elite foisting of race upon America is not consistent, not only with American principles, but what American people believe. So if you believe in these kinds of things, we want you to sign our petition at colorusunited.org. And if you don't want to speak on behalf of yourself when your company is doing diversity and inclusion training, or your kids are getting discriminated on the basis of race, contact us and we will speak up for you, and we will use the power of millions to elevate your voice.
Well, the interesting thing here is it's a somewhat of a conundrum, I guess, or a catch-22, unless you subscribe to the so-called received wisdom or the prevailing narrative, you're considered a racist. I mean, you've probably seen that yourself in spades, right?
Well, it's funny that Asian Americans are now being put in a position where they have to accept their own discrimination. They're actually being pressured right now by the Academy to say, oh, no, it's not really that bad. You know, it's fine if universities, you know, treat us differently than other races, because you know what? Black people need their shot. They need their chance. They need their shot in this country. And, you know, it's funny because the immigrants who have worked so hard to get into this country so that their kid could get a shot in this country, and their kids come back to their immigrant parents, and suddenly they've said, oh, I reject my heritage. I reject you. I reject that excellence that you've put upon me. So that's the really, really sad part about what's going on about all this.
Yeah, and you point out in the book as well that Asians lack the cultural capital to make their case in the mainstream media. The cultural capital, what do you mean by that?
I think that the cultural capital is something that is attained when you are more visible in the culture and when you speak out. You know, here's the thing. In China, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, if you spoke out, oftentimes you were tortured and you were killed by Mao. But in America, if you want to do anything in this country in politics, you have to speak out. And Asian Americans have not been speaking out enough for their own rights, and they need to speak out more, not just for themselves. In fact, not even for themselves. They need to speak up for meritocracy. They need to speak up for Martin Luther King's position that people should be treated on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. That's what they need to speak out for. And hopefully my book, An Inconvenient Minority, will encourage Americans of all races to speak out more in favor of individualism and meritocracy.
Well said. And I thank you for manning the ramparts and writing the book again, An Inconvenient Minority, The Attack on Asian American Excellence and the Fight for Meritocracy. By the way, what's that website again in case anybody needs a little bit of assistance in, you know, fighting the battle and, you know, running up that hill then where they're accused of being, you know, systemically racist or otherwise? What was that website?
Absolutely. It's colorusunited.org, Color Us United. We have all of the experience in the world fighting these institutions. I fought Harvard, and you can fight any institution that comes your way.
Well, it's a must read, and it's just out this week. Again, An Inconvenient Minority. Kenny Hsu is the author. Aaron and Sandra Stockton have fostered 100-plus children over 27 years, and they believe there's always room for one more. Let's find out exactly how they got involved in this adventure of a lifetime. Aaron and Sandra Stockton, appreciate you coming on board because this is a great story, and we could use more of the same in this day and age. Let me start with you then, Aaron. I mean, what started you on this adventure, as I call it?
I'm going to let my wife take that one because... She started it.
Oh, okay. She started it in a nice way.
Yes. What happened was I was in active duty military service, and I got off active duty to go into a reserve unit. And I was sitting home one day, and my husband and I lived alone. Our children were grown and gone. And I was reading a newspaper article about a young Caucasian girl that the agency was looking for foster parents for. The problem was she was pregnant to an Afro-American boy, and they had never mixed races in their program. So I saw that story, and I said, oh, we got to get that girl. So I made a phone call. I talked to my husband first. He said, babe, whatever you want to do, do it. I made a phone call and made an appointment and went there to find out about the young lady. When I got there, there were two other parents there for that same little girl. It was me, myself, Afro-American, and two Caucasian women said, we got to get this girl. We believe when we got there, we were told that she was already placed. We believe that was a bait-and-switch story from the agency trying to get foster parents. So we all three did our training together, and it said several weeks, and we got our children. So the child that we got, that we wanted, was Caucasian, but like I mentioned before, they didn't mix races. And I said, listen, I've been in the military working with all different color and races of people, and we all work together. There is time for us to change that because this child needs a home, and what she requested is to be in a home with no children. I said, my husband and I can provide that home. We have a big enough place. She can pick her own room, and we have no kids in here, and she can come. So I went to my husband. I told him, and I asked him if he agreed. He said,
yes, let the child come. And also, see, I was in the military also, so, you know, as my wife said, we associated, and a lot of our friends are from every race background.
All over the world.
Well, you broke a racial barrier. I was going to say,
We tried hard, and once we did that, we had a little Chinese girl. Once we did that, they had homes because there were enough Afro-American parents out there. There were more Caucasian children. So we broke that mold. So now our parents are getting, it doesn't matter what color you are and what language you speak, we're going to figure it out. As long as we got Google and translate languages, we're going to figure it out.
It's a lovely, lovely story. I mean, the idea, you know, love is a universal language, and it doesn't know any race, color, creed, or whatever. But it's kind of like you're the Jackie Robinson of fostering. In
effect. We try.
Well, you're doing a great job. I mean, 100 plus. Do you know exactly the number, by the way?
We know it's over 100, maybe 120, 130, something like that. Because at one point when we started on foster care, we could have
three persons at a time, kids. And then also I can also say it's probably more than that because I worked at a girls' group home and a boys' group home, so I, you know, tutored those kids also. So it's been over yeah, 100 plus.
Probably about 120, 130, somewhere around there. You know, because we're in a treatment foster care program, not just regular foster care. That meant that every child that we got had some kind of mental or physical issue. And me being a military nurse, I figured I could probably handle almost anything. And my husband being my partner for so many years, we just celebrated our 48th anniversary. I figured we were like on the same sheet of music. We thought alike. We figured we could handle whatever came our way. We're going to give her our best shot. That was our plan. That's what we did.
Well, you're living in a state of grace for sure. Aaron and Sandra Stockton, who have fostered over 100 kids in the span of 27 years. So what is the quality that is most important to being able to do what you do and make sure, you know, that these kids have a safe and, I'm guessing, a somewhat happy environment to grow up in? Aaron, any idea what is that? Or Sandra, go ahead.
What I think about that is when we take a child into our home, we have to mesh them in and make sure that when they're ready to leave, they're ready to deal with life. We bring them in not like they're a foster child, but like they're our child. It's like going to Disney Park. You can speak to that, Aaron.
Yes. As Sandra was saying, they become part of the family. You know, if we're going on, a lot of foster parents, they going on vacation, they put their kids in respite or send them away. No, these kids go with us. This is our family. We try to teach them family values, like let's sit at the table and eat together, you know.
Teach them grace
and give them chores. Some of the kids we would get dropped out of school, and my first priority when we were doing the 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds was getting them a GED. Mm-hmm. Getting a job, even though they might tell me, I don't want to work at McDonald's. You're getting a job, you know, mm-hmm. And driver's license, checking account. So when they move on, they're set, you know. So that was one of the most important things for me, Sandra.
And going back to that, we had a young man. Well, at our house at one time, we had three children, two Caucasian and one Afro-American. The Caucasian young man was the older one. The other one was the baby one. So we all went out to Olive Garden for dinner one night. We thought it'd be funny with summer, and they all said, yeah, let's go to Olive Garden, Mom. Let's go to Olive Garden. They all called us Mom and Dad. The young ones, the older ones, started. We got older, they called us Nana and Pop-Pop. We were always there. So we went to Olive Garden, and we're sitting down, and we're having a menu, and we're helping them order what they want. All of a sudden, the oldest one started looking really sad and had tears in his eyes. I'm like, to my husband, I'm kicking him under the table. What's wrong? Because we didn't have him that long, so we didn't know what was going on. And then I just put my hand on his arm, and I said, what's the matter? He said, I'm happy. He said, but I never believed that black people live like this. His father was a Ku Klux Klansman.
Oh, boy.
And he just cried. And I said, well, you know what? Everybody does the same thing. It doesn't matter what color we are or what language we talk. We go to dinner. We go to movies. We do all those things, you know. And I'll let my husband talk about, he passed. He came to us. His issue was alcoholism. We went to Al-Anon every class we could go to. We helped him work. We helped him get a GED. And we thought he was ready to go, and he was old enough to go to an apartment, but he had, you know, went back to some old friends and started drinking again. And one night we got the call that he passed. I'll let Aaron speak to that.
And so myself and Sandra, we were the only two blacks in at the funeral. And after the funeral was over, let me go back. Richard told me, the kid told me that my dad, I can't even take you over my dad's house. He wouldn't let you in. So after the funeral was over, this guy came over and hugged me and said, hey, I'm his dad, and I want to thank you for taking care of my son. He said he spoke very highly of you and your wife. And so, you know, it was, and I went back to my seat, and I was sitting next to the kid's mother, and she said, I can't believe it. So, Sandra?
Not the kid's mother, but his father's mother. She was like, oh, my God, I can't believe my son shook her hand. She said, he's pretty much the only one in the family that's like that. The rest of us are not. We're all okay. And she was like, I don't know where he got that from. She said, but I tell you what, I think you made a change in him with what you do with our son. So we were really happy about that, because I think those are the things people think about. What makes you keep doing it? What makes you happy? Because those happy things come back. And when they reach out to you, we had a young lady. I'll say her name, but she says it's okay to talk about her. Her name was Michelle, and that was the first one I talked about. She found us on Facebook, and I saw it was about 3 years ago. And she said, are you Mama Stockton, and Dad Aaron that live in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I said, that would be us. Are you Michelle? And I said her last name. She said, oh, my God, Mama, that's me. And she always told us, she was going, she called us Mom and Dad, and she told Aaron, when I grow up and get on my own, and she graduated high school, she did well. When I graduate high school, I'm going to marry a military man like you, Dad. She grew up and married a black army soldier, had three twins, a set of twins, and when she got in touch with me, she was in Germany doing quite well. So
Sandra,
I'm saying it's okay to have different people in your house. It's okay.
Well, it sounds like it's been more than okay, and you give them a structure, and I said, you know, surround them with love and stability. It's almost like they're having religious epiphanies here. I don't know if religion is sort of a bedrock foundational part of the way that you approach these things, but do you stay in touch with the kids, Sandra? I mean, to a point, like you mentioned, you know, graduating
you
high
know,
school.
With that social media, they all know grandma's name. They all know papa's name, mom and dad. They know our name. They hit us all the time. Yes, we're in touch with a lot of them we're not in touch with. We're in touch with quite a few. And some of them have lost their life because, like I told you, when the kids come, they have problems. And you try to work with them. We had one young man, Caucasian. We loved him. He's such a sweetheart. And his problem was a problem with his father. There was something in between they couldn't get along. And, like, he I know his birthday was coming. And we planned a birthday party for him with our family because by now he knows all our grandkids. And we had a party, we had a good time and everything. His father called the next day, he wanted to have a party for him, take him to the home. And I'm like, and I hear my phone say, but I had a party yesterday with my foster parents. I felt so bad because I didn't know his real father was planning something for him. He didn't tell us and he didn't call him, so we couldn't change that. And he was just telling us, I hate him. And we're teaching him, we don't want you to hate him. Whatever happened, we need to figure out how to fix it, you know. And we tried very hard, and he would go out, supposed to be in school, hook school, and one day he hooked school and he went to the metro station, and he was breaking in cars, stealing. And he got caught. Somebody saw him. They called the police. And he was a high-speed chase on TV. And we're looking at the news, and it's our kid. We couldn't believe we saw his face mask in the car when they were chasing him. So he got to the hospital, and they were looking for his parents. He told them who we were. And when we came to the hospital, emergency room, where they had him, and he was handcuffed, of course, but he was there. And we said, we're his parents. He's like, you're his parents? I said, we're black, but we're his parents. So can we please get in there? We had our paperwork. So we went in to see him and everything, you know. And he couldn't come back to us because now he needed a higher level of care than we could do, right? And he was placed in another a detention center for that for a while. And he was only in there about 3 weeks and he hung himself. We were so broken. We were so broken.
Yeah, understandable. Let me ask you.
If there's something else.
Well, Sandra and Aaron, are you still taking in foster children now? I mean, at this point, are there any children within the house?
Well, there's no children in the house, but we have created a big foster family thing going on. Both of our daughters are foster parents, and our oldest daughter adopted to her daughters. And our youngest daughter, she's a communal foster parent. What that means is, like, the children coming across the border.
Yep.
Captured crossing the border and everything. Don't speak our language. And our daughter's bilingual. She gets those children because they need somebody to speak Spanish to help get them on track. And she learned how to speak Spanish when she was like in third grade. We were stationed in New Mexico. And she wanted to be Mexican. She said, no, I'm be like the Mexican little girl. They can speak Spanish. And when we left there to go to Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland, USA, she just never gave up Spanish. Every class she took, every school, college, everything. So she's great. So both of our daughters are foster parents. So whenever we had somewhere to go, we kind of dumped our kids on them. They said, we might as well get our own kids now. You ain't got no kids. What are we going to do? So both of them have kids, one each. And we, if they ask somewhere to run, it's a quickie or somewhere, we'll take care of them. But we're no longer in the agency because we're tired. We're kind of draining. Right now, we're actually writing books. I'm writing books. I'm an author. I just came a new author. So we're tired, but we found something else fun to do. We're doing that.
Well, you're doing the Lord's work is what you've been doing, and
trying.
Over 27 years, 100-plus kids who've been put in foster care with Aaron and Sandra Stockton in Maryland, you're doing a righteous thing. I appreciate it very much and wish you the best
Thanks
of success
so
in whatever it is that you do going forward. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Connie. To all your listeners out there, there's always room for one more.
News out out of a northern Michigan town called Omena, where they're holding a mayoral race. It's a mayoral menagerie, by what I understand. It includes a goat, a chicken, and a cat. Let's find out from Sally Shapiro, the president of the Omena Historical Society and chair of the 2021 election. What the heck is going on in Omena? Tell us about the candidates. A goat, a chicken, a cat. I think there are several dogs in there as well. What are you doing by way of electing a mayor here? Is this a serious endeavor? First of all, how big is Omena?
Omena is about five buildings. On one end, you have a bar and a restaurant. On the other end, you have a church.
Oh, good. So it's a thriving metropolis.
Exactly. So we're on Grand Traverse Bay, and it's a full year-round community, but also lots of summer people. So Omena Historical Society has been around for 30 years or so, and we started 15 years ago with this fun mayor's race. We're unincorporated, so there's no elected officials. And we do a fundraiser, $1 a vote. You enter your animal. And so Penny the chicken is actually back, which she was on the council 3 years ago. She's actually the only child that has a candidate. So we made her VP of foul issues. She's running Penny again. Who knew chickens lived that long?
Well, you know, find a bureaucrat that works for chicken feed. That would be a real, eye opener there. So now who is the current mayor? Or what's the current mayor?
Sweetheart the cat is a tiara-wearing cat that won 3 years ago. The candidacy that spread around the world. Now she is running again, but she is more mature. She has on a much more sophisticated hat with a string of pearls.
Ooh, she's an attractive-looking feline, too, by all accounts, as I see. But is she now the front runner? Who's the current front runner to be the mayor in Omena, Michigan?
It's kind of a cat fight. It's a dog-eat-dog competition, politics. We're heavy into the puns here. But it's really Sweetheart, and we have quite a good competition running. There's a chihuahua named Chip that is the first time we've had a Mexican running in our campaign. I don't want to talk too much politics, but there's a golden whose entire platform is to get rid of the Mexican chihuahua, and the favorite thing that the golden ever destroyed was the self-respect of a chihuahua. So the answers are all quite funny. It's just really fun sense of humor, and all the money raised goes to the Omena Historical Society, and it's just a fun, different way than your basic dinner party or whatever.
Now, was that the Historical Society or the Hysterical Society?
There you go. See,
yeah, no. I too can play that game.
You want to nominate?
No. No. I'm guessing they have to be four-legged critters. The goat is in there as well. Who's the goat? I mean, is this the greatest of all time as a mayor, or is it a real-life goat?
Well, it's an actual goat. And actually, Sandra O'Day is the candidate running the goat candidate now. And her father ran 3 years ago. In 2018, and that was when Sean Spicer was in Washington, and Harley did this funny video talking goat campaign, so we made him our press secretary, because if Washington taught anything, it's that you need a good press secretary. So Sandy has actually been in a magazine before, in a knitting magazine, so she's our centerfold model that's running.
Attestation to just how deep the rot has set in academia, and even to the point where students are emboldened now to take on tenured professors, and they don't care a lick about that. The activism is so aggressive or assertive that nobody is safe, especially if you hold a conservative point of view. And by that I mean, if you're really open to things like free expression and debate, there are certain points of view where, unless you're really singing off the activist's hymn book, it's considered to be intolerant or something that they cannot tolerate. We saw this. I mean, the fortune of Lindsay Shepherd actually having a tape recorder that day, and we're with her university professor. upbraiding her for having thoughts that some may find offensive. I mean, my God, that should have put it all in pretty sharp focus. But this professor at Wilfrid Laurier, again, I don't know, would you send your kids there or Ryerson or any of these places where in the humanities or the social studies, it's just, it's gotten to be a culture of, I suppose, well, it's a unidimensional culture. David Millard Haskell has joined us on the line. He's a professor of digital media and journalism as well as religion and culture at Wilfrid Laurier University. Yeah, the idea that, you know, there's an anti-conservative bias on campus, and you cite your own experience, your lived experience, as well as empirical evidence. So let's start with that. I mean, give us an indication of just how bad it's gotten.
Well, you know, as a social scientist myself, I like to first go to the empirical evidence, and we've got reams of it now. Most recently, just in March, Eric Kaufman, he's out of the University of London, but he looked at the U.S., the U.K., and Canada, and he was able to show conclusively that among groups, conservatives face the most discrimination on campus. And that's interesting because they're really the only group that have no protection on campus. So he estimates that in terms of the professors on campus, between 4 and 6% may be conservative or identify as conservative. Mm-hmm. And what he maps is that they are leaving early. When they can take early retirement, they do because of the hostile environment. Similarly, grad students who are conservative, they are not pursuing academia because it's just too hostile. And students, undergrads, they find no support because the mentors who might share their worldview just aren't there.
You know, it's interesting. You use the term hostile twice, hostile environment. You've had a figurative target on your back as well, and you're a tenured prof. What's your experience as far as that's concerned? Give us an indication of just, you know, how dire the situation is now.
Yeah, so I apologize. I mean, I don't know how you were trying to fill the time, but so if I'm plowing the same field, let me know. But just this last semester, for example, I had a student who hijacked my class, and we were teaching online, so it was a virtual hijack. What she did was she took over the chat, and she started accusing me of discrimination. She accused me for discriminating against her because of her sexual orientation, of which I didn't know until, you know, these claims were made. She accused me of discriminating against her for religion. I actually write about this extensively in the C2C piece, which is still up online. Ultimately, she filed a formal complaint against me. It never went anywhere because it was all based on falsehoods. But this was a process that I was subjected to. And you say, well, where do students get this idea that in order to make take a professor down, that they need to pursue it through harassment and discrimination charges? Well, they actually get that idea from the university itself. Our university has a website now that actually talks about professors who are using harmful speech. Well, there are very few of us, so they're talking about me, and I have a colleague as well, Will McNally. But then it advises students, you know, what you have to do is make sure that you pay attention to how they're abusing you, harassing you, discriminating against you, of which I don't do, right? Mm. But the wish is the father of the thought, is what they say, so they know what they have to look for. Similarly, even our student newspaper has had similar articles where it says, what can you do to get rid of a tenured professor? And again, they advise, well, you actually have to take the route of discrimination and harassment, make those claims. And so it wasn't surprising when this student made those claims, because it seems like that's what they're being advised to do. There was another example. I was contacted by an administrator at my university who is equivalent to the equity police. And she let me know that one of the assignments I was asking my students to complete in my public speaking class, it was possibly in breach of the Ontario Human Rights Code. And the suggestion there was, you know, if you breach this is a fireable offense. And she said that the area that I had infringed upon was the protected status of both race and gender. You see, because I'd asked students, I'd said, I want you to do a persuasive speech. And I was getting them to argue either for or against, although I was encouraging them to take the harder side for some controversial issues. For example, should trans women be able to compete in women's sport? But I said, you can argue either side. Again, I'm encouraging to take the whatever they deem the harder side. But her thought was, well, if someone is to argue that trans women shouldn't compete in women's sports, well, that is going to breach the Ontario Human Rights Code. And in fact, it's not. I mean, that's a blatant lie. The Human Rights Code does say you can't discriminate against people. And of course, I agree with that. But it doesn't say you can't debate ideas.
Right.
And so go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so this is the point where you had, you decided that you would present an objective lesson for the students, and yet some people would see that as offensive because it even had the temerity to bring up, you know, this aspect of gender or race or whatever. And, you know, branding anyone a racist or a white supremacist now seems to be, almost like saying, when did you stop beating your wife? You can't get out from under it. The other thing that you mentioned here, Professor, is that there are current heresies. And, you know, I mean, some of these questions I've actually raised in the course of the program, which to me, you know, are just innocuous. It's just something to provoke or stoke a little bit of debate or discussion. And you're saying this is now renders you persona non grata on university at Wilfrid Laurier anyway, because you even raise the specter of these open-ended debate questions.
Well, this is the problem that people need to recognize, that open debate is no longer what's done on university campuses. We've exchanged we've said we're not going to pursue truth, and truth in this way is defined as a contest of ideas where these ideas come at each other so that we can decide where the best evidence is. But students aren't allowed to do that anymore. I mean, the very fact that this, I'm using air quotes here, equity police person said, you know, you can't ask them to look at the side we don't want you to look at. And I was asking them to use empirical evidence. You know, I didn't want them to come back with opinion. I wanted them to go and look at the science. And so when you can't look at empirical evidence, when suddenly empirical evidence, if it offends a certain group, is deemed bigoted, we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Because often the only time you can find a solution to a problem is by looking at all sides of the argument.
Yeah, that it's come to this point, I found that very demoralizing in a way, having read the piece in C2C, as you mentioned. And I guess even more depressing to punctuate the point is that the dean and the administration did not have your back in this regard. Final word to you on this one quickly.
And this is the direction that it's going. So I had encouraged people, definitely, we haven't had a chance to go into all the empirical evidence that's showing just how conservatives, and even when I use the word conservative, it doesn't mean what it used to mean. What is now called conservative on campus was just yesterday centrist, even liberal ideas. So a lot of people will be surprised, but I would encourage people to go to that C2C piece to get the details, because if you are someone who has kids off at university and maybe your worldview and your family is either centrist or conservative, you need to prepare yourself and you need to prepare your kids.
A noteworthy warning, a heads up, and I appreciate your time. I hope we can do this again in the not-too-distant future and, you know, maybe flesh it out a little more fully, even though you've given us a salient points here, and it is a caveat when you're going into colleges or university campuses here in this country. David Millard Haskell, Professor of Digital Media and Journalism, as well as Religion and Culture at Wilfrid Laurier. Thanks so much for your time, and I wish you the best going forward, sincerely. You've got unscrupulous advertisers or vendors who want to weaponize your sleep. I couldn't believe that I was reading weaponized sleep and something called dream incubation, which is beyond my purview to really fully appreciate and apprehend. But Robert Stickgold is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, and he studies the relationship between sleep and learning, and we've seconded him to fill in all the details. Professor Stickgold, good to have you on the Oakley Show in Toronto. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, listen, weaponizing sleep, this is an interesting phrase. I mean, what does that exactly mean, and how does that work?
Well, what it means is that while we sleep, our brain is actually incredibly active, and it's spending most of its time asleep processing our memories from the days. And we do this, the brain does a lot of this outside of our conscious awareness, but some of it is in our dreaming as well. And it turns out that you can influence people's dreams by pre-sleep suggestion. You can influence their dreams by playing sounds or music or spraying odors or poking them or rocking them while they're sleeping. And you can do this in ways that lead to changes in their behavior after they wake up the next day. So you can, here's an example, you can take people who are trying to quit smoking, and you can, while they're asleep, spray into their room a combination of this smell of stale cigarettes and rotten fish. And although they don't know this is happening and they don't remember it in the morning, they cut down on their smoking considerably over the next week or two. So that's the way that it can be used to help people. But you could imagine also using the same techniques to try to get people to make choices that they would not otherwise make. And what started this whole hullabaloo was Coors Beer deciding that they were going to try to alter the dreams of the 100 million Super Bowl viewers the night before to get them to dream about Coors Beer and about wonderful fresh air and sparkling water, and thereby shift their biases towards buying Coors Beer.
Wow. All right. And so the sensory perception, I mean, when you gave me the analogy of the smoke and the bad fish, I mean, although, you know, the guy could wake up, be a three-pack-a-day man, but never want to touch a tuna sandwich again, could also go in that direction, I suppose. I don't know. but, you know, so.
Well, they might never want to eat rotten fish again. That's true.
I see what you said. So, you know, and so is this relatively scientific and well-proven, empirically tested and all the rest, that this we call this dream incubation is an actual science?
Yep. So for example, the article about smoking, it's an article entitled Olfactory Aversive Conditioning During Sleep Reduces Cigarette Smoking, and it's published in the Journal of Neuroscience, one of the top neuroscience journals in the US and in the world for that matter. We have published papers starting to look at techniques for dream incubation in the hopes that it can be used to increase creativity or to decrease depressive or PTSD symptoms. And the first study, which had to do with creativity, was published in a journal called Consciousness and Cognition. But the ability of our sleep to affect our memories, there's close to 1,000 published papers over the last 20 years on the topic. We're busy while we're sleeping, and our brain assumes that it's paying attention to its own internal thoughts, its own internal memories, and it really isn't protected against outside influences.
But you're saying otherwise. Again, Robert Stickgold, professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, where he studies the relationship between sleep and learning, and I guess the lessons that are imparted are absorbed. And I'm kind of curious then, not to get too deeply into the weeds, but what you're implying there is that the conscious versus the unconscious mind at play?
Well, it's a little bit of that, but from the dreaming perspective, it's you have to decide for yourself whether you think that the dreaming brain is conscious or not. We certainly don't remember most of our dreams. So in that way, it becomes a little bit like subliminal advertising, which the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. has banned, but has not extended to dream incubation at this point. But it's sort of that same thing of sliding things into your unconscious so that you wake up in the morning and you say something like,
Well, I don't think I feel like a cigarette this morning. That's really weird. But I do feel like a Coors beer.
Let me ask you on that Coors example.
Yeah.
100 million people watching the Super Bowl. So this is what Coors attempted to do. How did they attempt to do that, and how successful were they?
Well, I don't know the numbers on how many they got to participate, but they said that they were going to do a study of dreaming, and they asked people in return for a coupon worth a half off on a 12-pack of Coors, or if they sent the link to a friend, a 12-pack for free. And the plan is that people would watch this video before they went to bed, about a 5-minute video with music in the background. And then while they slept, they would play a soundtrack, an audio stream of music on their computers in their bedroom to sort of infiltrate their dreams. So that was the plan. And obviously the goal was to get the people to wake up the next morning with a bias towards buying Coors beer. We don't know how many actually participated.
Right. Boy, that sounds on the surface.
But I'll give you another example.
Right.
It sounds scary, but here's a scarier one, okay? There are 40 million Americans who have Alexas or other smart speakers in their bedrooms. Think about that. Those speakers play whatever Google or Amazon or whoever wants it to play. And you could imagine advertisers buying time on your Alexa speaker in your bedroom at night, playing advertisements, playing music from advertisements that were seen all over the web and TV the day before. I could imagine in another 2 to 5 years that Alexa will be able to tell when you're asleep and what stage of sleep you're in and target your REM sleep for these dream incubation techniques. And we would never know that it's happening.
Well, that sounds rather insidious and unscrupulous, if I can use those two words. So do we need regulation that would certainly prevent this from happening? I mean, if you're saying we're already on that slippery slope.
I think we do, and we've published a letter online calling for that. I've texted to my senator here from Massachusetts, urging her to get the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission here in the U.S., to make a ruling that dream incubation is unfair advertising practices. I think it's necessary. I mean, you know, the title we had on the article at first was "They're Coming for Your Dreams," and I sort of feel that way. If they're going to come after our sleep, I don't know what we have left.
Well, yeah, even more sinister would be governments, you know, with some agenda who, you know, may want to inculcate people in their minds. I mean, this is really, say futuristic, but it's happening in the present, and we have to forestall this development. Although I must say, you know, as you had pointed out earlier, in treatment of certain afflictions, you know, or addictions and people with PTSD and things like that, it can be used as a positive tool, can it not, this dream incubation?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, all the tools of advertising. You know, here in the U.S., I'm sure up in Canada, too. I mean, we're doing everything we can to take all the tricks of advertising to get people vaccinated against COVID, right? I mean, if we could figure some way to do some dream incubation that would get people to go and get vaccinated, if they agreed to it, you know, I'd be all for it. I would not be in favor of me being the one who decides what they get. You know, what they get taught and what they don't. I don't think that's my place any more than the government's, but absolutely it can be a powerful tool for good or for evil.
By the way, just out of curiosity, what's the difference between this and hypnosis?
We don't know, but we do know that these infiltrations into our sleep are incredibly effective. They can enhance our memories. They can enhance actually skills that we have learned during the day. So typing skills, visual skills, auditory skills to identify particular sounds or images, can improve over a night of sleep, normally do improve over a night of sleep. And we don't see that so much with hypnosis. Hypnosis has been used, is used for treating smoking, for people who want to quit smoking. So it's they're just different paths in probably to the same memory systems, to the same emotional systems that determine what our biases are.
And are you more susceptible if, say, you're a very sound sleeper, you know, there's the REM sleep that just before, you know, you wake and it's the dream phase, or if you're an insomniac, are you less susceptible? Does it matter what quality of sleep you get?
We don't know. And it depends to an extent on what we're trying to actually influence. I would suspect that the poor sleepers and good sleepers would be equally susceptible to dream incubation and similar techniques. That would be my guess.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and issuing this caveat on a need-to-know basis. A lot of us really weren't aware that this was something that could be weaponized. Your own sleep could be used against you. And so for that heads up, Professor, really appreciate your time this afternoon. We'll all sleep well now knowing it.
Yes, I hope so. Take care.
Thank you. Robert Stickgold, again, prof of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. He studies the relationship between sleep and learning. That's a wrap for the Oakley Show podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Turn the dial to 640. Listen live at 640toronto.com or search the name John Oakley on Spotify.
Thanks for listening to the John Oakley Show podcast. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you get your on-demand audio.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.